Blog Talk Radio.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see. Through days dark and stormy, while great Lenin led us, our eyes saw the bright sun of freedom above. And Stalin, our leader, with faith in the people, inspired us to build a land that we love. Destroyed the invader and brought to our homeland the laurels of fame. A glory will live in the memory of nations, and all generations will honor her name. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our premiere showing of Back in the USSR. That was Paul Robeson, an American communist, African-American, singing support for the Soviet Union, especially during World War II, which never let us forget that 20 to 27 million died fighting the fascists through the course of World War II. And thank you to Sigrid for allowing us to rebroadcast his shows. You can see his blog spot where all the collection of shows are originally posted at. And thanks again for listening to Radio Free Kansas. Here is the most recent, Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
To Back in the USSR, you're on 93.3 FM CFRU. I'm Siegfried, and I want to do something a little different today. I've been talking about, maybe not so different. I've been talking about the atrocities, the genocide that's being waged in by the apartheid state of Israel against the Palestinian people for weeks now, basically since October. But yesterday, the 21st of January 2024 was also the 100th anniversary of Vladimir Lenin's death, the great, the revolutionary who did so much to transform the 20th century and change world history and really empower working class and oppressed people all over the world to fight back, to resist. And, you know, we see how the Palestinian people are resisting, and, you know, and obviously we've been talking about, like, the atrocities, the suffering, the everything that's been going on. We've been talking about that for weeks now. You know, we could talk about how there are no functioning hospitals in Gaza right now out of, I believe, a total of 38 before the latest round of hostilities. None are still functioning. There is not a single functioning hospital in Gaza because all of them have been destroyed. And, you know, one wonders, I mean, and this is something that that Justin Podor talked about on last week's episode, why it would take the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, so long to make a ruling when there are such clear cases of war crimes. You know, just by the book, classic textbook definition of war crimes being carried out before our eyes, and the most documented, you know, you can see this stuff on social media, the most documented case of genocide probably ever. You know, it really boggles the mind. But when we talk about someone like Lenin, who really changed the world and empowered people, working class, oppressed people, gave them the tools to fight back against a system that is just crushing them and you know, displacing them and killing them and tearing apart their lives. And when we talk about him, we have to resort to poetry to understand just how this person who really is not the impact of his actions in the Russian Revolution and beyond, we don't get that in school. We don't get that in school in this part of the world. We don't understand him, or what he fought for. This is one of the reasons why we have to resort to poetry to understand. And the great African-American poet and Harlem Renaissance figure Langston Hughes wrote two poems about V.I. Lenin in the 1930s. They reflect the tremendous spirit of hope that the Russian Revolution breathed into the national liberation struggles of black people in the United States and all oppressed peoples around the world. And I'm going to go and read two of these poems right now. The first one is entitled Lenin. Lenin walks around the world. Frontiers cannot bar him. Neither barracks nor barricades impede. Nor does barbed wire scar him. Lenin walks around the world. Black, brown, and white receive him. Language is no barrier. The strangest tongues believe him. Lenin walks around the world. The sun sets like a scar. Between the darkness and the dawn, there rises a red star. And the second poem, Ballads of Lenin. Comrade Lenin of Russia, high in a marble tomb, move over, Comrade Lenin, and give me room. I am Ivan, the peasant, boots all muddy with soil. I fought with you, Comrade Lenin. Now I have finished my toil. Comrade Lenin of Russia, alive in a marble tomb, move over, Comrade Lenin, and make me room. I am Chico the Negro, cutting cane in the sun. I lived for you, Comrade Lenin, but now my work is done. Comrade Lenin of Russia, honored in a marble tomb, move over, Comrade Lenin, and leave me room. I am Chang from the foundries, on strike, in the streets of Shanghai. For the sake of the revolution, I fight, I starve, I die. Comrade Lenin of Russia speaks from the marble tomb, on guard with the workers forever. The world is our room. So it was two poems of Lenin, written in the 1930s. So obviously they were epitaphs to Lenin, who died in 1924. January 21st, 1924. And you know, I feel that there's so much that could be said about his career, which spanned decades. I mean, he was only 54 when he died of a stroke, but he lived. Like, just he lived. You know, just so many rounds of struggle, so many organizations building, you know, as part of founding movements and all the everything he wrote, you know, all the different, you know, both inside Russia and abroad, you know, from thinking he would never see the Russian Revolution happen in his lifetime to actually being one of the leading figures of it, to where his presence could actually inspire, you know, through these difficult times of when Russia had gone to pieces in the First World War, you know, this land where people, the vast majority of people could not read. The vast majority of people had never seen a doctor. And yet they were being thrown at machine guns and torn apart on the battlefields and expected to die for a government that frankly did not care about them, that exploited them. You know, a government of the Tsar that increasingly was a capitalist government, people like working in factories and, you know, for pennies a day. You know, living in squalid workers' barracks and having to spend company scrip to buy anything, weren't even paid with real money. You know, this is the kind of thing that they rose up against. You know, also centuries of serfdom, of the exploitation of the peasants on the land, didn't have land, who had to work for landlords, they were exploited every turn of their life, you know, did not have control over any aspect of their life. And that is what finally broke down. And that world ended in 1917. And when we see, when we go over to this article that Lenin actually wrote in March of 1917, called "To Our Comrades in the Prisoner of War Camps," so basically to Russian soldiers who had been captured by the Germans in World War I and who were about to be released. This is what he wrote to them, and I think we can see some parallels about like what people are fighting for today in places like Palestine, in Yemen, in Iraq, you know, in Sudan, in all these places where oppressed people are fighting, rising up. So this is what Lenin said in March 1917. He said, "Comrades, a revolution has taken place in Russia. The Petrograd and Moscow workers were again in the vanguard of the great freedom movement. They staged a political strike. They demonstrated in the streets under the red flag. They fought like lions against the Tsarist police, gendarmerie, and a small section of the army that did not immediately side with the people. More than 2,000 were killed and wounded in Petrograd alone. The Russian workers bought our country's freedom at the price of their blood. The workers' demands were bread, freedom, peace. Bread, because, as in nearly every other country involved in this robber war, the Russian people are suffering from hunger. Freedom, because the Tsarist government, taking advantage of the war, finally turned the whole of Russia into one big prison. Peace, because the Russian workers, like class-conscious workers of all other countries, do not want to go on dying for the interests of a handful of the rich, do not want to continue this criminal war started by crowned and uncrowned freebooters. The insurgent workers were joined by most of the men of the Petrograd and Moscow garrisons. The workers and peasants in soldiers' uniform extended a hand of brotherhood to the workers and peasants, not in uniform. The honest-minded part of the officer corps joined the revolution. Officers who tried to go against the people were shot down by the soldiers. The revolution was carried out by the workers and soldiers.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Ярких атак. И вновь продолжает с тобой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте на мосты. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает. Жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути.
И вновь продолжает с тобой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный, а когда впереди.
Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I'm Siegfried, and that was Lenin is Young Again, Lenin Kakoi Maladoi by Lev Lutsenko, Soviet singer. And before that, we of course had the iconic speech from The Great Dictator, which I believe was put out in 1942 by Charlie Chaplin. You know, one of the greatest, you know, I would say like socialist speeches of the time, you know, and of course in a Hollywood movie of all things, you know, you would never see that kind of thing today. And yet the message that it delivers there, I think that's the message that he would want to give to the people of Palestine today. He would stand in solidarity with them, just as he stood in solidarity with Jewish people who were resisting the Holocaust. And Lenin would also want to send a similar message, because, of course, he stood on the side of oppressed and colonized people all around the world. In fact, the requirements for admission of Western communist parties from, say, like France and Britain into the Comintern, into the Communist International in the early 1920s, was that they renounce colonialism, that they reject colonialism, they fight against colonialism. That was, for them to get in the door, they needed to do that. They needed to reject empire. And of course, then we see, of course, like what, you know, communist parties around the world, they all fought against empire. They fought against, you know, socialist revolutionaries overthrew French colonialism in Vietnam. They overthrew Japanese colonialism and European colonialism in China. They overthrew American colonialism in Cuba. And just go on and on, you know, overthrowing European colonialism in say Burkina Faso, or Angola, or Mozambique, or any of these places. or even in Yemen, where, of course, the United States is bombing and attacking as we speak, it had a Marxist revolution. It fought against colonialism. And now, of course, it's doing so again, you know, and taking a principled stand on the side of the Palestinian people. You know, even though it didn't have to, there was no real politique reason for Yemen to get involved, and yet it has, you know, with, you know, essentially denying, you know, Israel access to the Arabian Sea and the Red Sea, and effectively taking all these shots, you know, forcing the United States to respond and taking hits basically for the Palestinians, you know, standing in solidarity with them, you know, making life difficult for those who are oppressing them. This is what they're doing. You know, this is what solidarity looks like. You know, and this is the kind of thing that Lenin, if he was here today, would support. You know, he would support that solidarity. He would support, of course, he'd be in the streets. He'd be organizing. He'd be standing in, like, you know, he'd be organizing these mass protests, which are putting incredible pressure on, you know, politicians throughout the West and making them, you know, forcing them to backtrack, forcing them to at least try, you know, to respond to mass demands. And you know, and they thought that the solidarity for Palestine would only last days or weeks, but it's been there for months. It will continue. It will continue to grow. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that we need to understand. I mean, the, you know, figures such as Lenin, you know, or Fidel Castro, or Mao Zedong, or any of these people, they are not these figures to be worshipped by, you know, these cloistered, you know, people within the realms of like just communist parties. Many communist parties in the West simply exist to worship the past. You know what I mean? They have absolute contemporary relevance in the movements that exist today, in the struggles that exist today. You know, and we see the parallels with the struggles that were waged, you know, back then in 1917. In 1949, in 1959, the days of all these revolutions, it was not just against a class order, an unjust class order that oppressed working people and kept them down. It also was against colonialism. It was also against empire, you know, that was grinding the global south into submission, you know, under the boot heel of European colonialism. And of course, that continued on, you know, during the Cold War years under, now the U.S. is in the driver's seat. You know, and to this day, you know, and the U.S., of course, continues to back Israel to the hilt in this genocide that it's waging. You know, this is the, you know, Lenin stood on the side of the oppressed. And he didn't have to. He came from a privileged background in Tsarist Russia. And in fact, I just want to, you know, because I am myself a author, I want to quote actually a article that Tariq Ali, who's a, you know, Marxist academic in the UK, I believe he's originally from Egypt, written extensively on the Russian Revolution. This is an article he wrote for The Guardian actually in March 2017. Basically, the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and it's entitled "How Lenin's Love of Literature Shaped the Russian Revolution." You know, and it goes like this: you know, literature shaped the political culture of the Russia in which Vladimir Ilyich Lenin grew up. Explicitly political texts were difficult to publish under the Tsarist regime. The Russia essayists were holed up in asylums until they, quote unquote, recovered. In other words, until they publicly recanted their views. Novels and poetry, meanwhile, were treated more leniently, though not in every instance. The chief censor, of course, was the Tsar. In the case of Pushkin, The, quote, father of the people, Nicholas I, insisted on reading many of his verses before they went to the printer. Some, as a result, were forbidden, others delayed, and the most subversive were destroyed by the frightened poet himself, fearful that his house might be raided. We will never know what the burnt verses of Eugene Onegin contained. Nevertheless, politics by other means and in a variety of different registers permeated Russian fiction in a manner without parallel in any other European country. As far as politicized literature and literary criticism went, the Russian intelligentsia was spoiled for choice. They devoured the acrimonious conflict between the powerful critic Vissarion Belinsky and the dramatist and novelist Nikolai Gogol. He was cutting 1842 satire Dead Souls had invigorated the country and been read aloud to the illiterate. Success, however, proved to be Gogol's undoing. In a subsequent work, he recanted, writing of stench-ridden peasants and defending illiteracy. In the preface to the second edition of Dead Souls, he wrote, quote, much in this book has been written wrongly, not as things are really happening in the land of Russia. I ask you, dear reader, to correct me. Do not spurn this matter. I ask you to do it. Angered, Belinsky, the critic, broke publicly with him in 1847. Belinsky's widely circulated letter to Gogol gave him, the recipient, a long, sleepless night. Quote, I know the Russian public a little. Your book alarmed me by the possibility of exercising a bad influence on the government and the censorship, but not on the public. When it was rumored in St. Petersburg that the government intended to publish your book in many thousands of copies and to sell it at an extremely low price, my friends grew despondent. I told them then and there that the book, despite everything, would have no success and that it would soon be forgotten. In fact, it is now better remembered for the articles that have been written about it than in the book itself. Yes, the Russian has a deep, though still undeveloped, instinct for truth. In later years, critics became much more vicious, lambasting novelists and playwrights whose work they considered to be insufficiently empowering. This, then, was the intellectual atmosphere in which Lenin came of age. His father, a highly cultured conservative, was the chief inspector of schools in his region and much respected as an educationalist. At home, Shakespeare, Goethe, and Pushkin, among others, were read aloud on Sunday afternoons. It was impossible for the Ulyanov family, you know, Lenin was a pseudonym adopted to outwit the Tsarist secret police, to escape high culture. At high school, Lenin fell in love with Latin. His head teacher had high hopes that he might become a philologist and Latin scholar. History willed otherwise, but Lenin's passion for Latin and taste for the classics never left him. He read Virgil, Ovid, Horace, and Juvenal in the original, as well as Roman senatorial orations. He devoured Goethe during his 2 decades in exile, reading and rereading Faust many times. Lenin put his knowledge of the classics to good use in the time leading up to the October Revolution of 1917. In April of that year, he broke with Russian social democratic orthodoxy and, in a set of radical theses, called for a socialist revolution in Russia. A number of his own close comrades denounced him. In a sharp riposte, Lenin quoted Mephistopheles from Goethe's masterwork. Quote, theory, my friend, is gray, but green is the eternal life, the eternal tree of life. Lenin knew better than most that classical Russian literature had always been infused with politics. Even the most apolitical of writers had found it difficult to conceal their contempt for the state of the country. Ivan Goncharov's novel Oblomov is a case in point. Lenin loved this work. It depicted the inertia, indolence, and emptiness of the landed gentry. The book's success was celebrated by the entry of a new word into the Russian lexicon, Oblomovism, which became a term of abuse for the class that helped the autocracy survive for so long. Does any of that sound familiar? Lenin would later argue that this disease was not confined to the upper classes alone, but had infected large sections of the Tsarist bureaucracy and filtered downwards. Even Bolshevik apparatchiks were not immune. This was a case where the mirror held up by Gorchakov really did reflect society at large. In his polemics, Lenin often attacked his opponents by comparing them to almost always unpleasant and sometimes minor characters drawn from Russian fiction. Where the country's writers differed, and they were not alone in this, of course, was on the means necessary to topple the regime. Pushkin supported the 1825 Decembrist uprising and challenged the succession of Nicholas I. Gogol satirized the oppressions of serfdom before rapidly retreating. Turgenev was critical of Tsarism, but disliked intensely the nihilists who preached terror. Dostoevsky's flirtation with anarcho-terrorism was transformed into its stunted opposite after a terrible murder in St. Petersburg. Tolstoy's assault on Russian absolutism delighted Lenin, but the Count's mystical Christianity and pacifism left him cold. How, Lenin asked, could such a gifted writer be a revolutionary and a reactionary at the same time? Over the course of half a dozen articles, Lenin unpicked the deep contradictions at play in Tolstoy's work. Lenin's Tolstoy was capable of providing a lucid diagnosis. His novels recognized and expressed the economic exploitation and collective anger of the peasants, but not of formulating a cure. Instead of imagining a properly revolutionary future, Tolstoy had sought consolation in the utopian image of a simpler Christian past. In quote, Leo Tolstoy is as the mirror of the Russian Revolution. Lenin wrote that, quote, the contradictions in Tolstoy's views and doctrines are not accidental. They express the contradictory conditions of Russian life in the last third of the 19th century. Tolstoy's contradictions thus served a useful guide for Lenin's political analysis. Meanwhile, Lenin was repelled by Dostoevsky's cult of suffering, though the power of his writing was undeniable. Lenin's views on literature did not, however, become state policy. Just under a year after the revolution on August 2nd, 1918, the newspaper Izvestia published a list of people nominated by readers to whom monuments were proposed. Dostoevsky was second after Tolstoy. The monument was unveiled in Moscow in November of that year by a representative of the Moscow Soviet, with a tribute by the symbolist poet Vyacheslav Ivanov. The writer who had perhaps the strongest impact on Lenin, on indeed an entire generation of radicals and revolutionaries, was Nikolai Chernyshevsky. Chernyshevsky was the son of a priest, as well as a materialist philosopher and socialist. His utopian novel, What Is to Be Done, was written in the Peter and Paul fortress in St. Petersburg, where he had been incarcerated because of his political beliefs. What Is to Be Done became the Bible of a new generation. The fact that it had been smuggled out of prison gave it an added aura. This was the book that radicalized Lenin, long before he encountered Marx, with whom Chernyshevsky had exchanged letters. As a homage to the old radical populist, Lenin titled his first major political work, written and published in 1902, What Is to Be Done. The enormous success of Chernyshevsky's novel greatly irritated the established novelists. Turgenev in particular, who attacked the book viciously. What of the novel that was the subject of so much controversy? Over the last 50 years, I have made three attempts to read every single page, and all three attempts have failed. It is not a classic of Russian literature. It was of its time and played a crucial role in the latter phase of the Russian intelligentsia. It is undoubtedly very radical on every front, especially gender equality and relations between men and women, but also how to struggle, how to delineate the enemy, and how to live by certain rules. Vladimir Nabokov loathed Chernyshevsky, but found it impossible to ignore him. In his last Russian novel, The Gift, he devoted 50 pages to belittling and mocking the writer and his circle, but admitted there was, quote, quite definitively a smack of class arrogance about the attitudes of contemporary well-born writers towards the plebeian Chernyshevsky, and in private that, quote, Tolstoy and Turgenev called him the bedbug's thinking gentleman and jeered him in all kinds of ways. Their jeers were partly born of jealousy, since the subject of their snobbery was extremely popular with the young, and born also in the case of Turgenev of a deep and ingrained political hostility to a writer who wanted a revolution to destroy the landed estates and distribute the land to the peasants. Lenin used to get cross with young Bolsheviks visiting him in exile during the inter-revolutionary years between 1905 and 1917 when they teased him about Chernyshevsky's book and told him it was unreadable. They were too young to appreciate its depth and vision, he retorted. They should simply wait till they were 40. Then they would understand that Chernyshevsky's philosophy was based on simple facts. We were descended from the apes and not Adam and Eve. Life was a short-lived biological process, hence the need to bring happiness to every individual. This was not possible in a world dominated by greed, hatred, war, egoism, and class. That was why a social revolution was necessary. By the time the young Bolsheviks climbing Swiss mountains with Lenin were approaching 40, however, the revolution had already taken place. Chernyshevsky would now be largely read by historians studying the evolution of Lenin's thought. Classicism that was so deeply rooted in Lenin acted as a bulwark to seal him from the exciting new developments in art and literature that had both preceded and accompanied the revolution. Lenin found it difficult to make any accommodations to modernism in Russia or elsewhere. The work of the artistic avant-garde, Mayakovsky, and the constructivists was not to his taste. In vain did the poets and artists tell him that they too loved Pushkin and Lermontov, but that they were revolutionaries, challenging old art forms and producing something very different and new that was more in keeping with Bolshevism and the age of revolution. Many of Lenin's colleagues were more sympathetic to the new movements, Bukharin, Lunacharsky, Krupskaya, Kollontai, and to a certain degree Trotsky, understood how the revolutionary spark had opened up new vistas. There were conflicts, hesitations, and contradictions within the avant-garde as well, and their supporter in the government was Anatoly Lunacharsky at the People's Commissariat for Education, where Lenin's wife Nadia Krupskaya worked as well. Shortages of paper during the Civil War led to fierce arguments. Should they publish propaganda leaflets or a new poem by Mayakovsky? Lenin insisted on the first option. Lunacharsky was convinced that Mayakovsky's poem would be far more effective, and on this occasion he won. Okay, so that's all of Tarik Ali's article that I'm going to read on Lenin's literary background and the many inspirations that he had, which a lot of people don't really understand. He very much was a product of his time. All revolutionaries are. You know, nobody is truly timeless in history, regardless of, like, you know, and those people who basically are, you know, various historical figures can be appropriated by people of different, in different ages and things like that, and can be removed, you could say, from their, the period of origin, you know. I mean, obviously, like, Jesus is probably a very, you know, classic example of that. You know, how many different generations, how many different cultures and things have made use of him, you know, and you know, you can cite so many different examples, you know, of people who have just been blasted out of time and who have just been, you know, used in all manner of different cultures and time periods and things like that. But they all came from somewhere, some material conditions, certain material and cultural conditions, and that's where they emerged from. And honestly, this entire rant I've been going on, that entire quotation, I don't know if it's going to be useful to you as a listener. It largely is me just dealing with my own sanity as I try to navigate the landscape that we're dealing with right now, the completely mad landscape that we're in, you know, which, we're, you know, there's a genocide going on and people are telling us not to care and just, and, you know, mealy-mouthed politicians who basically just don't, they don't care but pretend otherwise, and you name it. I mean, it's just, it's a mad situation that we're in, and we do our best to navigate it, you know. We do our best to navigate, those of us who actually care, and it's hard, you know. And for those of us who really want to, you know, just, you know, we deal with it as much as we can through action, you know, through doing a radio show like I am, you know, and trying to articulate how we feel and try to inform the listener about what is going on in the world and about things they may not have heard of, you know, about the past and how it relates to the present. But it's very, very difficult, you know, it's very, very difficult always, you know, nothing about the present is ideal, you know, and we deal with it as best we can, always, we deal with it as best we can. But anyways, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to wind this show down, and basically I'm just going to end with a Michael Parenti's talk about the nature of imperialism, and as well as with some music. I'm just going to conclude with that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, and take care, brothers and sisters. I'm going to see you all here very soon.
In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907. This was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state." Now, you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people would say? Well, you're Marxist. Oh, you're Marx. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that. I used to hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually, you say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. I'd say things like, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I say, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I say, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they'd say all the time. And I say, boy, this guy Marx was really something. Here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. That's pretty good. And then I realize something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919, in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, they use. Political instability, undemocratic forces, we got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You say, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. See, we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too. Yugoslavia is a great case in point. I have a book there called To Kill a Nation. Got any more copies of it? Good. See, here comes the infomercial now. We start. There it is. Okay. Yugoslavia was tolerated for quite some time as a breakaway country from the Eastern Bloc of Nations, so-called Bloc of Nations. But after 1990, the U.S. saw no reason to tolerate its existence anymore. I mean, here was a country, a rather large country right in Central Europe, which was not going the way of free market reforms as was happening in Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, and all over. They were not doing that usual thing. They were not, at first they weren't. Yugoslavia had an economy that was 80% state-owned still. Yugoslavia had a high standard of living and a high degree of economic equality. Anybody could go to school to the highest level they want, and medical care was free. Yugoslavia showed no interest in joining the European Union, no interest at all in joining NATO. It had a productive industrial base, a successful auto industry. 80% of the Yugoslav auto market was sold by the Yugo. It had construction firms that competed quite successfully throughout, even in Western Europe. Now, when you destroy all that, you, of course, increase the value of your own capital. If I destroy your firms, I destroy your auto industry, I increase the value of my auto industry. If I destroy your agricultural base, I increase the value and open market opportunities for my agricultural base. And that's exactly what happened. German and U.S. agencies supported every retrograde secessionist and reactionary ethnic nationalist in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo. And today, Yugoslavia has been broken up into a cluster of little right-wing republics where everything is privatized, everything's been deregulated, sold off to private investors at garage sale prices. That's the public capital of the people's labor is now given away to private investors, where the media have been taken over by rich private investors or conservatives. Pension funds have been plundered and disappeared. Public services have been shredded. I was just in Belgrade last March, and I was with a friend, and she said, well, I'm going to meet you later. It was a Saturday. Now, I'm going to meet you later, but I'm going to a doctor's appointment. I said, what do you mean? It's 7 o'clock Saturday night. You're going to see a doctor? Who sees a doctor at 7 o'clock? She says, oh, here in Yugoslavia, the doctors will see you anytime you want because they're so desperate for patients. The public health services are broken down, so people are literally without, unless you can pay, are literally without services. And 7 was a convenient time for her. And the doctor said, okay, sure. There's inflation in Yugoslavia now. There's unemployment, poverty, suicide, prostitution. All of this has skyrocketed, and we hear next to nothing about it in the press. It's a free market paradise. It has been brought into the fold of the West. That's Yugoslavia today. And unfortunately, there were too many people on the left who supported that war and swallowed the official line. They swallowed the mass media line right down their throats. They thought they were fighting rape. They thought they were fighting a demon called Milosevic, and they didn't, and they were just ill-informed and taken in. It's much too bad. And I'm including some very notable progressive speakers who swallowed that line, including one who calls himself a pacifist.